I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. George Saunders stories can be bleak, brutal, and hilarious. And they're a perfect depiction of the American zeitgeist. Sorry, I had to use the word zeitgeist in your intro. Family men in the grips of status anxiety and class envy, company men cringing before their bosses and spying on coworkers, children under the thumb of rule-bound parents, criminals serving as lab rats for scientists experimenting with new drugs. Fun! In his work, science fiction is seamlessly incorporated into reality. His books include Civil War Land and Bad Decline, Pastoralia, and In Persuasion Nation. And his latest collection of stories is 10th of December, published by Random House. And I'm so pleased to welcome George to our studio. Hey, George.
Hey, nice to be here.
Well, this is a great book. I had to just tell you something just from my life, which is about 2 or 3 years ago when my son was 15, I picked him up from school, and he said, "We're reading this really cool book in English class." And he started introducing me to Civil War Land and Bad Decline, which, of course, I had read before. And I said, "And I actually know the guy who wrote it." And he said, "Well, it's just really awesome, and it's really funny, and everybody loves it." And the only reason I bring this up, I mean, you've gotten your share of good reviews, so you don't need to add that to it. But I think in a lot of the really adulatory reviews I've read, especially of your new collection, they take you so seriously that sometimes I feel like your stories get short shrift in terms of how much fun and how funny they are. I think it's in a way a bigger compliment that a 15-year-old boy likes your work than a book reviewer.
Yeah, I love that story actually. You know, because I had that for many years before I published. I had this idea that as somebody who's kind of naturally goofy and maybe a little scatological, and I thought you had to put all that stuff to the side, you know, and be very straight-laced and serious. And so for me, a big breakthrough was when I went, I can't get any heat this way, so I got to go back to the old kind of street virtues of, you know, being funny and being fast, being accessible, and trying, and sort of saying, yeah, it is an entertainment function. Of course it is.
Well, and it worked for Shakespeare, and it worked for Charles Dickens.
For Gogol.
Everybody. Yeah. I mean, but that's interesting. When did you, what was your experience up to that point? What were you trying to write? And then what was the aha moment where you said, "Oh, wait a minute, I can be funny, George," and that'll work too?
I had this medical affliction called the Hemingway boner. And so I was just trying to be Hemingway. And I'd worked in Asia, and so I thought I'd kind of collected up the requisite kind of, you know, exotic.
Rough-hewn.
Exactly. And so they were kind of realist, you know, those stories that sort of have a guy sort of going through something and having a wistful moment of realization at the end. And they were just sort of dead, you know. And then by this time I was working at this engineering company in Rochester, and I was taking notes at a meeting. And I was just – and I'd written this big book called La Boda de Eduardo, which I think means A Wedding of Ed. And spent, you know, better part of a year on it, 700 pages. And,
wow.
And the week before, I'd given it to my wife to read, and she's my best reader, you know. And if I can move her, then I know I've really scored. And so I gave it to her. And, you know, as writers will do, I said, "I'll give you a week, you know, and I won't bother you." And 2 minutes later, of course, I'm looking into the room, and she's literally got her head in her hands. She's on page two, you know, and it was just unreadable, you know. So that was kind of prepared me for this crisis. So I'm in this conference room, you know, and I just had jotted down these kind of Seussian, little bit perverted poems just out of boredom, and then brought them home that night and was doing something. And I heard her laughing from the next room, just kind of sincere pleasure. And it was the first time that I think I'd, you know, caused any pleasure in a reader in about 6 or 7 years. And something just, you know, it was almost like I was kind of getting beat up in an alley. And I'm like, "What's going on?" And then you notice you have one hand up behind your back.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, "Oh, yeah, funny is..." Now, were you always funny? I mean, in your writing, was that always your goal, or did you have other...
Well, I'm the one doing the interview, George.
So far, we'll see.
But thank you for the compliment and assuming that I am funny. But you know, I think that you know, funny. I'd be interested in knowing what your childhood was like, because I've, you know, in talking to comedians and funny writers, it seems like funny is sometimes you know, kind of our last resort. Like, you know, I think if I was the youngest in my family, I don't know where your birth order works
first,
out.
Oldest,
first.
Yeah.
That's unusual. You see, now that's unusual, because usually I find that the firstborn tends to be the responsible. Maybe that's who you thought you were supposed to be.
I was responsible and funny.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You did it all. No need for any other children in that family. But did you get credit for being funny? Or like with that, what was your impulse to be funny? I think the firstborn already gets so much attention that he doesn't usually have to be funny.
Well, you know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago in the late 60s, early 70s. And at that time, it was really, comedy was very respected.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So,
you had the whole Second City and
Steve Martin and George Carlin were all, and so you could get a lot of respect at school or wherever by being able to, one thing that, you know, we used to kind of do impersonations, but mm-hmm. also these kind of impersonations of fictional characters that you were inventing on the fly. So mm-hmm. we used to do that. Actually, I was on a basketball team and we would taunt the other team by, you know, making up names for them and voices and so on. So I think that was one way. A way of getting a little power, a little attention. And mm-hmm. in that community, also in my family, it was really respected. If you could do that and get away with it, then you could sit with the grown-ups. And it was, you know, kind of a respectable thing to do.
Were you under the impression that girls liked a funny guy? Because I was sort of led...
Up to a point.
I was led astray.
Yeah,
I would read those Playmate data sheets, and they always said they liked somebody with a sense of humor.
Yeah, they liked it to a point. Yeah.
Up to a point. They liked the football players better.
Yeah, they liked the funny ones as friends.
So how did you wind up, you were working at this company doing technical writing, was it Radeon, is that
Radeon,
what it's called?
Yeah,
Radeon.
Yeah.
That sounds like a company you invented in one of your stories, but maybe there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
What was the kind of writing you were doing?
Is an environmental engineering company, so what mm-hmm. we would do is work with a big client like Kodak or Xerox or the Department of Defense and, you know, go in and do a field investigation of a closed-down military base or a contaminated site or something, and then just kind of write up the results. So mm-hmm. it was great training in minimalism because they didn't want a lot of, you know, of flash. But also, of course, you know, you're in this kind of strange environment where it was pretty truthful. It was pretty straightforward, but there was always an element of slight spin, you know.
Right.
If you spilled a barrel of cyanide, actually what happened was potential contamination may have occurred in a certain region of the site. You know, that kind of slight tweaking, which if you're a writer, that sort of lights you up a little bit.
Well, that's what's so much fun about all of your stories. I always feel like you're creating these workplaces with their own language, and you just sort of let us jump in and medias res. There's no explanation. So we're always playing a little bit of catch-up in your stories, which I think is one of the really fun things. It's a little bit of a detective game, figuring out, okay, what's going on? Who's that? Where are they working? And when you sit down to write a story, do you have a sense of like an opening scene that's going to be kind of confusing, then we're going to be sort of off our bearings, then we're going to have to catch up?
And usually you're absolutely right about that. But usually I'll have written a kind of conventional first scene. And then at some point in the process go, oh, yeah, actually, I don't need that. And if I get rid of it, I'm in a more intimate relationship with the reader. You know, I don't have to say there was a small conference room with a conference table and it was, you kind of would assume that.
Right.
So one of my sort of revision exercises is just to keep trimming out any place where that's at all extraneous or repetitive, and then the subtotal is that we're kind of being smarter together, me and the reader.
Right, and then we get to congratulate ourselves for getting it, which is part of that's one of the there's a little serotonin lift in there. You say, oh, I get what he's doing
exactly, and I think that's how it works in a friendship. You know, if we're out somewhere and I say, would you like to have a beer, which is an alcoholic beverage, and we'll go into a saloon, which is a place where people... But if you just kind of walk by a bar and cut your eyes over at it, then suddenly we're kind of...
Right. We're in cahoots.
We're in cahoots.
I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to George Saunders, who has a great new book out called 10th of December. It's a collection of stories. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I was hoping you would perhaps read a little bit
from
one of your stories and maybe cue it up for us like we're on a... Run the Tonight Show.
Well, I think this is just the opening of the first story, and it's kind of I've been goofing around a lot with what I call a third-person ventriloquist, which is where you're doing a third-person story, but as quickly as possible, you're trying to get into a character's head.
Right.
And use, in this case, her diction, you know, to try to get a more intimate relationship with the character. So a couple pages? Okay, all right.
Absolutely.
So this is a story called Victory Lap, and this part is just it's a 15-year-old girl kind of messing around in her house by herself waiting for her mom to come. So she's the only person home, although it will seem different. 3 days shy of her 15th birthday, Allison Pope paused at the top of the stairs. Say the staircase was marble. Sage, she descended, and all heads turned. Where was Special One? Approaching now, bowing slightly, he exclaimed, "How can so much grace be contained in one small package?" Oops. Had he said small package? And just stood there? Broad prince-like face, totally bland of expression? Poor thing, sorry, no way, down he went. He was definitely not Special One. What about this guy behind Mr. Small Package, standing near the home entertainment center, with a thick neck of farmer integrity, yet tender ample lips, who, placing one hand on the small of her back, whispered, "Dreadfully sorry you had to endure that bit about the small package just now. Let us go stand on the moon, or in the moonlight." Had he said, "Let us go stand on the moon?" If so, she would have to be like, eyebrows up. And if no wry acknowledgement was forthcoming, be like, I'm not exactly dressed for standing on the moon, which, as I understand it, is super cold. Come on, guys. She couldn't keep treading gracefully on this marble stairwell in her mind forever. That dear old white hair in the tiara was getting all like, why are those supposed princes making that darling girl march in place ad nausea? Plus, she had a recital tonight and had to go fetch her tights from the dryer.
Excellent. Yeah. That story, you talk about third-person ventriloquism. You actually go in and out of several different characters. You have this guy who comes to abduct her, and then you also have the next-door neighbor who has to play the hero.
Right.
And you don't – it's that same thing where you don't really tee them up at all. It's like, you know, right. The voice changes subtly and we'll say, oh, wait, that's not the girl anymore.
Right.
And I mean, I think that – did you ever, when you were starting as a writer, when you were starting to get published, did you ever have an editor who – said, you know, coming out of that whole Raymond Carver, Hemingway-esque thing where everything is kind of, it's sort of simply laid out, or just deceptively laid out. Your stuff, you eliminate all of that, all of those signposts. Did you ever have an editor or a publisher say, you know, George, you've got to make this a little clearer. We're having trouble getting it.
You know, I never have, except in really helpful ways. Like in this story, and I work with Deborah Treisman at The New Yorker, who's just like a master editor. And on this one, she just suggested, and she was absolutely right, that originally that first line wasn't in there. So it just would have said, it would have started with, say the staircase was marble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one too many.
Right.
So she said, just, you know, just get us into the house. So on a very, on a micro level, she, you know, that happens. But I think my hope would be that by the time I'm sending him out, a reader who's leaning in will get it. You know,
right.
That's kind of the hope. And then, like I say, if it works, then you get that kind of explosion of mutual respect that happens.
Right. Well, and, you know, 15-year-old boys get it. So that's a very good sign.
It's true because, you know, I do a lot of readings at colleges, and it's incredible how many good readers there are who really are alert at that level. So I think it's a safe assumption.
And you teach writing at Syracuse.
At Syracuse.
And you have for some time. How long have you been
since
teaching?
Since 97 or 96.
Wow.
Like yeah.
Wow.
It's a great place.
What are your classes like? Are people coming to you because they want to write like George Saunders?
I don't think so.
You don't get that?
Mostly last year we got 520 applications for 6 spots.
Mm.
So they're already writers. They're already great writers, and they've already, you know, gone down the path, their own sort of individual path. But, I teach a forms course, which is kind of like literature for writers, and then a small workshop. And the whole thing really is just to kind of urge them up to do the thing that only they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so good, they could choose to be imitation Faulkners or blah, blah, blah. But to get to know them over the 3 years and kind of go, all right, I think if I say this, her work's going to get up into that sort of high atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really rewarding work and really a lot of fun.
Now, you're somebody, at least in my memory of you, you always have been very well known, and you've gotten a lot of acclaim. You got the MacArthur Genius Grant, so that's sort of a stamp of approval.
Yeah.
But this book has really gotten, you know, this huge amount of attention, I think more than I've seen for any of your previous ones. What do you chalk that up to? Do you think, has your writing changed? Has the audience changed, the readers changed, or is it some combination of the both?
Well, honestly, I mean, there was this piece by Joel Lovell in the New York Times Magazine that was so beautifully written and generous, and, you know, that just sort of was like shooting the book out of a cannon.
Right.
So, and we had a great, you know, he came up and we spent quite a bit of time together, and there were, so that was, I think that was really it. But also, I think the kind of a, like a mini goal or a submerged goal over the last 5 or 6, 7 years was for me to just, it's hard to say without being corny, but I wanted to try to get a little more light into the stories to sort of say, well, things don't always go badly. They sometimes do, and we should, it's sort of almost a moral imperative to remember that they sometimes do. But also, sometimes life is great, and sometimes people at the crossroads do have the reserves to make the right decision. And as somebody who, you know, 54, and my kids are grown, and I've definitely been very lucky. So then you think, well, there must be a way that that valence can be represented in fiction. It's a little harder, I think, than dystopia. But mm-hmm. as a personal goal, just to kind of get to the point where I could really let in some of the positive valences of life as well as the negative, just as a technical sort of challenge. And I think I kind of started down that path in this book.
And you actually mentioned, you mentioned your acknowledgments, your two daughters and how mm-hmm. they kind of reveal to you the human capacity for good in all of us. And that's, you know, that's a cool thing to say. Actually, your personal story, I there's a lot I didn't know about you. I didn't know that you were a practicing Buddhist, and that's a big part of it. Can you tell me how you got into that and what effect that's had on you?
Well, I was always, ever since I was a kid, I was really, spiritual is kind of a bogus word, but I was raised Catholic in Chicago and in the 60s. So that was a real, like, rich kind of metaphorical, symbolic system. So really, ever since then, I had this feeling that that it would be really weird if our what we could know, our capacity for knowing stuff, was exactly matched to the scope of the universe. Wouldn't that be a weird coincidence? The other generations, Ben Franklin, he couldn't grasp the iPod, you know, but we just happen to have everything we know. So I think that kind of leads you to, you know, to look other places for it and to try to, so that's, you know, but I'm just a very, very, very beginner, so I kind of don't.
Oh, so this is new. This is new to you.
Yeah, so. So that I don't really talk about it because I don't, you know, Yeah.
But I do think in your fiction, you know, aside from what your religious practices are, there's a lot of wonder and there's a lot of mystery. I mean, you don't, you know, your stories bear rereading because the first time there is like, okay, you can enjoy it on the funny George Saunders mm-hmm. entertainer level, but then you can reread and reread and get that sense of, oh, there's a lot George doesn't know and he's letting us know that he doesn't know.
Oh, thanks. I think, you know, this is a kind of a weird thing to say, but for me, it's kind of, there's a technical corollary, which is I do a ton of revision, like mm-hmm. maybe OCD level revision. But that, to me, has something to do with this idea of openness and mystery, because if you're coming back to something 6,000 times, you're really looking into every corner and kind of asking stuff to come forward and be, you know, be unresolved and so on.
Well, it's a great book. I recommend it to everybody. I've been speaking with George Saunders. His latest collection of short stories is called 10th of December. It's published by Random House. And George will be in conversation with Deborah Eisenberg, another favorite of mine, tonight at 7 at the Strand Bookstore. That's at 828 Broadway at 12th Street. George, thanks so much for coming
in.
Congratulations.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.